evening and welcome to this, our first presentation in our sixth series of talks on Kentucky Live. Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I moderate this series with my colleague with the gray hair, Peggy Wright, back here, with help from our absent website guru, Haiwan Wan, who's currently in Beijing, China. Our technical specialist tonight is the library's technology coordinator, David Runner. Our speaker tonight received her MA and EDS from WKU for her groundbreaking research on Asiatic cholera in Kentucky, 1832 to 1872. A timely topic, I guess, what with the revival of swine flu. In 1975, she joined the faculty of the Department of Library Special Collections, where she's currently a professor and specialist in Kentucky history. Since then, she's become one of WKU's most prolific authors. Her early research focused on 19th century medical history in Kentucky and resulted in two books, David Wendell Yandell, Physician of Old Kentucky, and Luke Prior Blackburn, Physician, Governor, Reformer. In the 1980s, she began studying the role of the USO and visited 16 states and several foreign countries, and this resulted in a series of articles with titles like Soldiers in Grease Paint, Camp Shows in the Foxhole Circuit. She also collaborated with Carol Crow Carrico and Michael Morris to publish Bowling Green, A Pictorial History. In the 1990s, she began research on the history of English women in colonial South Africa while co-authoring a bicentennial history of Bowling Green and Warren County. In the new millennium, she co-authored the centennial history of WKU in 2006 and wrote Healing Medicine in the Bluegrass in 2008. Tonight she's here to talk about her latest project, editing the Civil War diary of Josie Underwood, a member of a politically prominent Bowling Green family. It's one of the few intimate accounts of the Civil War written by a Southern woman sympathetic to the Union. It's our great pleasure to welcome Nancy Baird.
Thank you. I want to start out by playing a game. I want all of you to close your eyes. And then I want you to imagine that thousands of American soldiers have come to your neighborhood to protect you and your community from the enemy. Now, imagine that a squadron or two of these nice young fellows have parked their jeeps and their tanks and their trucks and other vehicles on your front lawn. And they've also pitched their tents in your backyard. And they've cut flowers from your garden to brighten their abodes. And they drill every afternoon in your side yard. And they've burned your fences and your lawn chairs and your picnic table in their evening campfires. And to provide better surveillance of the enemy that might come to harm you, they have cut down all your trees and all your shrubs. In addition, they've helped themselves to the food in your pantry, your refrigerator, and your freezer. And they've made free use of your bathroom facilities, including bath linens, soap and shampoo, shaving cream, hair and toothbrushes. And now, a bunch of them have invited themselves in each evening to watch their favorite program on your TV. What do you think? I see some of you look just a little mad, gnashing your teeth, etc. But remember, these guys are here to protect you from the enemy. Josie Underwood's Civil War diary addresses these kinds of issues as they related to her family and her community when 25,000 Confederate troops occupied South Central Kentucky for 5 months, and then a large Union army controlled the area for 3.5 years. And what she says about Bowling Green and what happened here could just as easily have applied, probably did apply, to every area of this state. A few brief quotes from Josie's rather caustic pen will give you an idea of what occurred in Bowling Green during the Civil War and why her diary is so unique. But first, let me give you a little background about Josie, her family, and the plight of this town and state. The Underwoods, Josie, her four much younger siblings, and her two orphaned cousins lived with her parents on the outskirts of the farm they called Mount Air. We know the area today as Mount Air Estates. On the outskirts of Bowling Green, which was then a town of about 2,000 and the largest community between Louisville and Nashville. Josie's mother, Lucy, was the daughter of the chief engineer of the 1830s Green Barren River Improvement Project. Josie's father, Warner, was a well-known local attorney who enjoyed several terms in the Kentucky Legislature and the U.S. House of Representatives, and then served a couple in the U.S. House of Representatives. Her uncle, Joseph, was also a prominent local attorney, served a couple terms in the state legislature, 7 years on the Kentucky State Court of Appeals, 4 terms in the U.S. House, and 1 term in the U.S. Senate. Both Underwoods were slave owners and fearful of what Abraham Lincoln and his Republican supporters might do to this nation. And both campaigned vigorously in 1860 against Lincoln and for John Bell of Tennessee, who voiced no stand on slavery, but promised to uphold the Constitution. Yet, following Lincoln's election on the second Tuesday in November, and the secession of South Carolina and 6 other states, and eventually several border states, both Joseph and Warner worked diligently to hold Kentucky in the Union. Pro-Union, anti-Lincoln, slave owning, an interesting combination, and rather typical of Kentucky, where 1 family in 4 owned slaves, and where Lincoln received a mere 1,300 votes across the entire state. He received 5 in Warren County. He received 3 in Logan, and received none in Simpson County. Kentucky briefly tried to remain neutral, but most Kentuckians furnished soldiers for both sides. The Civil War tore this nation in two, and Kentucky was strategically important to both sides. Rivers served as the highways, the interstates of 19th century mid-America, and Kentucky controlled the major rivers west of the Appalachian Mountains. The Ohio River flowed the entire length of the Commonwealth's northern border and then joins the Mississippi, which flows for about 100 miles on our western border. 2 of the Ohio's major tributaries, the Cumberland and the Tennessee Rivers, flow through Kentucky and are navigable by steamboat as far south as northern Alabama and central Tennessee. These were the routes, the era's interstate highways for carrying men and goods to market and to battlefields. Control of them was absolutely essential. In addition to these river highways, and potentially far more important, the L&M Railroad, which was completed in October of 1859, and its line to Memphis, finished in March of 1861, connected the Upper South's 3 largest population centers with the Lower Mississippi and the industrial area of the Upper Ohio River. And this railroad went right through the middle of Bowling Green, making Bowling Green a virtual doorway into and out of the Confederacy. Many called Bowling Green the Gibraltar of the Confederacy. Lincoln supposedly said, and this is always a supposition, that he hoped God was on his side, but he had to have Kentucky. Josie's diary begins in the 1860 Christmas season during the 20-year-old's visit to her married sister in Memphis. In the heart of Tennessee's secession country, she heard considerable talk about secession, and occasionally she lost her cool by getting into the fuss with ardent secessionists. On her return to Bowling Green, she realized, and I quote, that the all-absorbing question here, as in Memphis, is the breaking up of the Union. Pa seems to think if the border states stand firm, the Union may yet be saved. Throughout the spring of 1861, the arguments became louder and the tensions grew stronger, and Josie's pen became sharper. February the 5th, 1861. The policy of Kentucky is neutral, but the people are not, goodness knows. Every man, woman, and child is either rebel or Union. All the older and thinking men know disunion means ruin to the South. Josie related specific examples of this emotional conflict. February the 5th, 1861. Today, when Cousin Marius came in, he threw the little bag of mail on the table and with great excitement said, "Uncle Warner, the Union people have got to have more rowdies. They can't be successful without more rowdies. I went up to the depot when the train came in, and all the riffraff in town were there. And when the train came in and started off, they all yelled, 'Hurrah for Jefferson Davis!' And they yelled and yelled till the train was gone. And now every man on that train will think Bowling Green is rebel, when she's really Union. Can't we get a pack of rowdies to yell Union when the train comes in and leaves?" March the 10th. Brother Warner had a fight yesterday with one of the schoolboys who called him a Yankee and an abolitionist. Warner knocked him down and said he told the fella he would teach a low-down cur to call him a Yankee and an abolitionist because he was Union. Pa told him that a gentleman should not have a rough and tumble with a low cur fella. But Ma's admonition to knock down anybody who called him such bad names carried far more conviction. April the 13th. It has happened. Fort Sumter was fired on yesterday. When the news came, we were all waiting on the front porch when Marius came galloping furiously up the road. As he came nearer, we heard, "Fort Sumter fired on! One woman got hurt. Harriet Lane, shot in the stern." What was a woman doing there anyway? I think we all know Harriet Lane was the USS Harriet Lane, a ship, not a woman. April the 17th. Lincoln has called for 75,000 troops. This means war, surely. Warner wants to volunteer. Think of it. A boy of 14? Of course, Pa won't hear of it. May 3rd. Ma says she never will, as long as she lives, consent to be driven out of the Union and give up the flag and all it stands for to a lot of meddling Yankees. And she never will forgive the hot-headed fire-eaters of the South for going out of the Union and giving the Northerners an advantage. June 13th. I asked Uncle George, "Which side are you on?" And his answer was, "I deplore the conditions, but talking too much does a great deal of harm, Josie, a great deal of harm." June 20th. The streets are crowded with farmers and country people who ought to be plowing their fields. But how can they go quietly about such occupations until they have the news of the day? August 25th. We are all distressed, and dear Ma is heartbroken. Uncle Went has resigned his commission in the U.S. Army. Ma wept and said over and over, "Oh, if he had only died or been killed defending the flag and the country for which his father fought, rather than turned traitor." And she begged us never to mention his name to her again. September 20th. It has come. The Philistines are upon us. Kentucky's neutrality is over. On the morning of the 17th, Simon Bolivar Buckner and his host of disloyal Kentuckians rushed by rail from Camp Boone and took possession of this town. September 21st. I started into town this afternoon, and near Bob Strange's shop, we had to stand aside and wait till thousands of men marched by. And then I saw our big front gate swing open, and the whole army marched into our front field of 100 acres of beautiful red clover. September 23rd. Tara Freeman, who I had not seen since I was in school in Russellville, asked me if he could come call on me. And I told him, "Not in that uniform you can't," which surprised him. He said he supposed I was rebel, to which I answered, "Why would you have supposed that? Did you ever hear me express admiration for Benedict Arnold?" September 25th. This afternoon, thousands of troops came out again to drill, and it seems that our front field is to be the established drill field. The beautiful clover is already trodden down and ruined. September 29th. Indignant, distressed, helpless. That's what we are. This afternoon, a whole brigade of infantry marched straight through our yard to pitch their tents in our barn lot and pond orchard. And there, they are camped for God only knows how long. And already, the new chestnut rail fence around the orchard is being burnt in their campfires. The soldiers are everywhere, even in the kitchen. And the best stables in our barn have been appropriated for the horses of the officers. These are Missouri troops, and I'm glad I don't know any of them. October the 3rd. Things go from bad to worse. More soldiers continually coming into town. I must give up my horseback rides, unless I have an escort. October the 5th. Another brigade marched up the hill and camped in the fruit orchard, and the few apples left on the tree are fast disappearing. These troops are from Mississippi and are better looking than the Missouri troops and better mannered. And we need the map. Okay. A quick look at this map of Bowling Green. Now, this map was done in 1863 by the Union Army, but it's the first map we have of Bowling Green, and it's good for giving you a feel of where the troops camped. I've read several places where if you looked at the terrain of the old part of town, the part that you see there that's town sat down on a reasonably flat plain. And there is a rim that runs around the town, kind of like a soup bowl. And there are high points on that rim. And these are the places that both the Confederates and then the Union fortified. I think we would probably call it more like making observation points than actual fortifications. But if you go on top of some of these hills and use your imagination and imagine that all the trees have been cut down and all the weeds have been cut short, you get a good feel for how the armies could signal back and forth to each other. Years ago, can you hear me without this? Years ago, before the highway department took the top off of Baker Hill, I took a bunch of Boy Scouts up here one Saturday afternoon in the late fall after the trees had lost their leaves. And standing on Baker Hill on the other side of the river, you could see the rooftop of the Bowling Green Country Club, which sits right next to Fort Webb. If you ever want to see what these forts look like, go to Fort Webb. In November, December, January, after the snakes have gotten out of the area. Because it truly does look like a fort that a bunch of Boy Scouts built on Saturday afternoon. It's not what you and I think of as a fort, but from Fort Baker, you could see the rooftops at the country club. You could see the cupola on top of Riverview. If you stand behind Riverview in the wintertime, you can see the river as it meanders back behind it. Pines Bluff, I'm not real sure where it is, but I think it's about where Veterans Boulevard crosses the Morgantown Road and where the new Walmart's is. It sits up on a hill. It's somewhere in that vicinity. This is the Fort... Fort Walmart. This is the largest hill in the town. This is where Western sits. Go up and stand on the top steps of Van Meter Auditorium in the wintertime. You can see halfway to Missouri. Or stand on the second floor of Cherry Hall and look north. And you can see, you can almost see to Indiana. So you get this great feel of how they can see anything coming by rail, by road, by river, and how they can signal back and forth. Ryder Hill is about where the University Church of Christ is up there on the corner of 13th and
Park
Street. Thank you. About where Regina Newell lives. This is where Reservoir Hill is, the red, white, and blue water tower. Again, if you stand up there in the wintertime, you can see for miles and miles around. This is Regina's house. This is where the red, white, and blue water tower is. And this is where the Underwoods lived. And there was a hill behind their house, you know, where Mount Air Estates is. And from Baker Hill, you can see the rooftops, you can see the red, white, and blue water tower, you can see Cherry Hall. I mean, you have this wonderful view of how they signal back and forth. You can see anything coming in this direction. October the 9th. There is no use trying to keep up visiting with the Secesh girls. We are too intensely interested, too wrought up, too suspicious, too distrustful of each other to make any get-together pleasant. We are not in sympathy on any subject. October the 12th. Nothing new has happened, just the same trying intrusions and annoyances from the soldiers and continued sorrow at seeing our dear old home being destroyed. The fields are all downtrodden. October the 14th. Shortly before breakfast, 100 men with gleaming axes marched up the front walk, and instead of going around the house, marched straight through the front door and out the back door to the barn lot, where they commenced cutting down a grove of walnut and oak trees. I guess they learned that the shortest distance between two points was a straight line. November the 20th. Nearly all the fences are gone, burnt by the soldiers in their campfires. The soldiers respect nothing. December 3rd. It is cold and sleety, and a sad sight we saw as we came from town this evening. Bob Strange's Cooper shop has been taken for a hospital, and as we passed there, we had to wait to let soldiers bring out to the wagon the body of a poor fella who had just died with measles, which ran into pneumonia. And while we waited, it was pitiful to hear the poor fellas in the hospital coughing and to see the pale, forlorn-looking men who were regarded to be up, and to think of how little of needed care they could have in these conditions. I might point out that there are no records that give the exact number of those who died, but among the Confederates, of 20 to 25,000 troops in this general vicinity, at least 3,000 died in a five-month period. Those are unbelievable statistics. And they died of measles and pneumonia and typhoid and you name it, everything imaginable. Just imagine those troops from Mississippi who were poorly clothed, living in little drafty tents in a Kentucky winter. It explains a lot of the pneumonia. December 4th, Ma had at least 5 gallons of nice chicken soup and almost as much of whorehound syrup made today, and Uncle Lewis took it down to the hospital and brought back a grateful and gentlemanly note of thanks from the surgeon and doctor in charge. So I think it's kind of interesting, this strong Union woman is providing medicines. One of the doctors asked her why, and she made the comment that as long as any mother's son was sick, she would do all she could to help him. But when that soldier got well enough to bear arms against his country, she wanted nothing more to do with him. It had, December the 8th, it has been snowing and raining, a cold, sleety rain for the past week, until the roads are all half-frozen slush. The streets are horrible, and our yard is so trampled over that it is scarcely any better. The poor Mississippi soldiers in the front orchard look too forlorn, bundled up to their ears with all sorts of fancy quilts and comforters. December 10th. I am so indignant. I had gone upstairs, leaving little Mary playing with her dolls in Ma's room, when she ran to the foot of the stairs calling, "Sis Josie, the soldiers are in Ma's room." I went quickly down, and there, making themselves at home in the two big rocking chairs, sat a captain and a lieutenant. "This is my mother's room, and she is ill and in bed," I said with all the dignity and sternness. But the captain said, "Yeah, yeah, I see, but we won't disturb her." How long, oh Lord, how long? December 25th, Christmas night, and what a sad contrast to all former Christmas days at Mount Air. No family gathering, only dear Ma, Pa, and me to make a pretense of merriment, to make the children and the Negroes happy. But as one little darky said, "Old Santa Claus got through with his pack in spite of the secesh." January the 2nd, 1862. Pa quietly held up the paper so we could read it. And this is what it said. "Warner L. Underwood and all persons occupying the building on Underwood's Hill, commonly known as Mount Air, are required to vacate the premises immediately by orders of the general." January the 3rd. Our last night at Mount Air. Tomorrow morning we leave. I can't write. I am tired and cold and heartbroken for my brave, helpless father and mother. Now, the Underwoods would spend the remainder of January and February in a log house over in Allen County that was loaned to him by a friend. And the diary talks about how nice these people are to the Underwoods and how much they help them. January the 22nd. Last night, about 11 o'clock, somebody knocked at the door. And when Pa opened it, who should stand there but old John Burnham? He is one of the most respectable of the secessionists in town and belongs to the Council of Ten, who are the citizens who manage and suggest local meanness to the rebels in command. He told Pa that in the council meeting, it was decided to have Pa arrested and sent south. Pa ordered his horse and went out into the cold night. Thank God he knows the country well, for he cannot go by public roads, which are well picketed, but must ford creeks and swim the swollen rivers. Doesn't that sound like fun in January? Now, with the fall of Fort Henry on the Tennessee River in western Kentucky, which opened a pathway for the Union Army down into Alabama, the Confederates decided to pull back to Nashville, and they hardly get to Nashville till they decide to pull on further back to northern Mississippi. The evacuation of supplies and the sick began from Bowling Green about February the 10th, and the last of the Confederate troops left Bowling Green on Valentine's Day of 1862. Hoping to discourage retreating troops from destroying homes and property that might fall into Union hands, General William J. Hardee placed Bowling Green under martial law and threatened that anyone who attempted to burn anything in Bowling Green would be shot without trial. This is his proclamation. Don't you know that might hesitate, make you hesitate just a little? Unfortunately, not everybody did. February the 12th, we are going back to Mount Ayer. This afternoon, two soldiers rode up to the door and gave Ma a note saying, Mr. Underwood, we are about to vacate your premises and advise you to take possession at once, lest evil people destroy the buildings. March the 1st. Mount Ayer is in ashes. Our home was left to us desolate. When we got within a few miles of town, Mr. Claypool stopped us and with sorrow told us that our home was burned. Both orchards were cut down. The avenue of big trees leading towards town were all gone. Not a fence in the entire 1,000 acres. Ruin, devastation, and desolation everywhere. Despite Hardee's proclamation, the Confederates apparently did burn some buildings. One of the things they did was destroy both of the bridges crossing the Barren River. There was a footbridge that was wooden, and it was totally burned. And it's hard to tell from the few engravings we have in the descriptions exactly what they did to the railroad bridge. The Union redid the railroad bridge as soon as they got here, and I can't imagine that it was totally destroyed and could be renovated quite so rapidly. Also, there were buildings on the square that were burned. Now, this is a Union engraving that appeared in a national magazine in 1863, and I don't think that the artist actually was in Bowling Green. I think he did it by description, because there are some problems with it, but it's all we have. You'll notice the courthouse standing in the middle of the square. This was a little log jail. This would be the northeast side of the square, and this would be State Street going down towards the river. As you see, some of the buildings have been burned. Certainly all of them weren't. How many actually were, how accurate the engraving is, we simply don't know. Josie's diary goes on and describes what happened on February the 14th. I will never forget. Shells were being thrown from Union cannons on Baker's Hill. They're lobbing them across the river and thrown around the square to save the depot, the roundhouse, and supplies. One shell crashed through the corner of Mrs. Hall's kitchen. Mrs. Hall lived just on the other side of where the railroad crosses Main Street, and there's a little brick building there that's been a tire shop, and I'm not sure what it is right now, but it's right on the other side of the railroad. One shell crashed through the corner of Mrs. Hall's kitchen, and a piece of metal fell into the biscuit dough that Aunt Sally was kneading. She rushed into the house where we were, all splattered with flour, saying, "Bless the Lord, a Union shell in my biscuit dough." Burning buildings all over town. The biggest fire being half the stores on the square, one of which belonged to Pa. When all was quiet, we saw 5 Texas Rangers ride furiously up to the railroad depot, jump off their horses, light torches that they had in their hands, and rush in and out of the depot, roundhouse, and buildings stored with materials, setting fire here and there. In a little while, the whole place was a mass of flames, a fearful and grand sight. One can only imagine what it must have been like that day. It was also snowing. So here you've got snow, you've got exploding shells being lobbed across the river, you've got retreating troops, you've got something burning, how many, who knows, but some buildings burning. You don't know how many others are about to go up in flames, and you're scared out of your wits that somebody might put you up against the wall. I just can't imagine such a day. Nanny said she was glad the Union soldiers were coming. She expected to embrace the first blue coat she saw. But alas, about daylight, we saw a squad of Union blue-clothed men. And they were a lot of hungry, coarse Dutchmen, German immigrants, in Turchin's brigade that were the first to advance in Bowling Green. Nothing could have been more unfortunate for the Union cause. As I mentioned a minute ago, we really just don't know how much was destroyed. We do know the footbridge was burned. We do know that the railroad bridge was put out of operation. We do know that a few buildings around the square were burned. An Ohio infantryman who was one of the first Union troops in Bowling Green made the comment that the rebels abandoned enough pork, salt beef, and other necessities to supply a division for a month. Another Union recruit suggested that the rebels abandoned so much that the injury to the Confederate cause could scarcely be greater than if they had lost 1,000 men slain in battle. Who knows? Probably neither one are quite accurate, but we don't know. But back to Josie. March the 1st, Union troops are steadily pouring in. No flag is so beautiful as the stars and stripes. Before I go on, these are the supports for the wooden footbridge, and as you can see, it's gone. If you look carefully, this is the support for the railroad bridge. Again, this isn't a drawing, it's not a photograph. Whether it was destroyed that badly or not, who knows? If so, the Union sure didn't put it back fast. And I love the Conestoga wagons coming across the river. Apparently, many of the Union troops went upriver to where they could ford the river. But some probably came across that way, and they managed to find rafts and anything else to get across, because on the 15th, the last Confederates were out of here on the 14th, and the first Union troops were in here on the 15th. March the 2nd, a Wisconsin regiment marched by this afternoon, and I think I never saw such a fine-looking body of men. All of our troops look splendid, well equipped, comfortably clothed. Poor Confederates, my heart goes out to them. See, Bowling Green wasn't very big. April the 1st, the streets are in horrible condition. Yet on and on go more troops marching south through the slush and mud. The hospitals here are full to overflowing. Last night, Ma came home from one and told me I would have to give up my room, as she had gotten permission to bring a poor boy who would die if left in the crowded ward. April the 6th. We are horribly uneasy. There were rumors today of a great battle. God have mercy and stop this cruel war. April the 15th. The rumor was true. This, by the way, is Baker's Hill on the far side of the river. The engravings don't necessarily go with the narrative. That's just all there is. The rumors were true. A terrible battle lasting 2 days has been fought at Pittsburg's Landing, Shiloh. Brother Warner, he's the young kid who was 14 that daddy wouldn't let go to the army. Brother Warner was wounded, shot in the arm. Ma, who had gone to see about her young son, writes that when they reached Pittsburg Landing, the sight of wounded and dying men was heartbreaking. At one place, surgeons were amputating arms and legs in a little cabin and throwing them into a pile out the window. May the 9th. The days are beautiful now, but this poor little town looks distressingly dilapidated. This would be Reservoir Hill. Again, Union troops. The buildings burned by the rebels have never been rebuilt. The streets are in dreadful condition. Ever so many hospitals full of sick soldiers and poor convalescent men, pale, weak, homesick. The soldier cemetery is getting bigger every day. June 14th. We are so delighted. Mr. Grider's father, who is our congressman, has given Brother Warner, the now 15-year-old, an appointment to West Point. The dear boy really wanted to go back to the front to rejoin his regiment, but Pa's judgment overruled. Pa pointed out to him how much better service he could render his country by being an educated man. June 22nd. Yesterday at the railroad station, there were two cattle cars crowded with poor Confederate prisoners, dirty, half-clad, unwashed, uncombed. They were trying to buy apples and pies from an old woman with stamps and Confederate chin plasters. It nearly broke my heart. I happened to have $5 of good U.S. money, and I bought a whole basket of pies and apples for them. Today, I was mad enough to knock a little upstart of an officer down. He came up to me with a smirk and said, "Miss Underwood, I heard of the incident at the depot yesterday, and as a friend, I would advise you to be careful of giving aid and comfort to the rebels." And I replied in a flash, "When I wish advice, I'll ask it from my friends." June 25th. Pa had a letter from Senator Crittenden and from old Colonel Grider saying that they had talked with Lincoln of Pa's loyalty and sacrifices and advised him to come to Washington. So it's left well. July, so the family goes to Washington and they're there for a while, and Josie meets all kinds of dignitaries. She meets the president, who she decides wasn't quite so bad after all, as she had hated him so much earlier. July 20th, Pa has been appointed consul to Glasgow, Scotland. August the 2nd, there was great excitement in town today. Soldiers dashing. Morgan is reported making raids pretty close by. Some say to cut the L&N Railroad. Some say to steal horses. August the 15th. This war is too heartbreaking and there seems to be no end to it. August 25th. More and more troops are coming back into Kentucky. People think the Confederates are making a desperate effort to get to Louisville. Goodness knows, I hope they don't succeed. And God forbid that they ever take Bowling Green again. August 28th. Hot. How dreadful for poor wounded men. There is a great deal of fever in the hospitals here. August the 30th. More and more raids by John Morgan. Bridges burned, tracks torn up, troops sent out of town, reports of skirmishes. September the 6th. We are going to Scotland sooner than we had intended for fear that Morgan will tear up the tracks between here and Louisville. September the 8th. Goodbye. Poor, dilapidated little Bowling Green, with friends and associations and estrangements. Goodbye, thou old journal, safe, silent, confident. Goodbye. And they went to Scotland. Unfortunately, Josie's diary ends as the family begins their journey to Scotland. Nevertheless, the diary provides an intimate look at the trauma discovered by civilians when war overran their home. As I edited this diary, I realized that it could have been written by a Louisville matron, or a Lexington lass, or a Danville dame during those towns' occupations, or perhaps by a mamselle during World War I, or a fraulein during World War II, or even by a modern resident of the Mideast. There are always more civilians than military personnel caught in a war's wake. And these civilians, like their neighbors and relatives in the military, pay a terrible price during war. Josie's diary belongs to the Kentucky Library, and how we acquired this diary is almost as interesting as what the diary actually says. After the war is over, the Underwoods come back to the U.S. and they spend some time in California and then come back to Bowling Green. Warner suffered a stroke in 68, died in 72, and the family never really recouped their fortune. Josie married in 1870, a New Yorker. She bore four children, lived in New York for a while and then in California. And a few years after her husband's death in 1898, she returned to Bowling Green. Josie Underwood Nasrow died in 1923. And in her will, she left her two-volume Civil War journal to her 18-year-old granddaughter, who was then living in Texas. Other family and friends, family members and friends remember hearing about the diary. We have a few things in the library that talk about having seen it, some quotes from it, etc. But when the large collection of Underwood papers came to us in the 1940s, this diary was not with the collection. And the rumor was that because Josie said some ugly things about some of her friends, and those friends had descendants that were still in Bowling Green in the 1940s, that maybe those descendants wouldn't appreciate things being said about ever so great grandma or whatever. Whether that's so or not, I don't know. But that's the rumor as to why the diary didn't come to us. Then one hot summer day in 1976, the Reverend Howard Surface brought us a package that he had received from the Dead Letter Office in Atlanta. And in that package was a typed copy of Josie's diary. From reading the typed copy, we know it was not typed by somebody from Bowling Green, nor somebody in the immediate family, because some of the names that anybody in this town would know, or anybody in immediate family would know, are misspelled. For example, Josie's brother-in-law was named Benjamin Grider. And anybody in Bowling Green knows the name Grider. And in this diary, it is typed Girder all the way through the diary. There are a bunch of other names like that. Who typed it? I don't know. We do have some samples of Josie's handwriting in the library. And it, her handwriting is challenging to read. I think probably somebody decided to type it so it was easier to read, didn't get around to correcting it, and who knows, maybe threw away the original. We don't know. We don't know who sent it. We don't know who it was sent to. All we know is it landed in the dead letter office, and that because her copy of her marriage certificate was on the front page of the diary, the dead letter office sent it to Howard, and he brought it to us, thinking that we had sent it to somebody. History's full of mysteries. And Josie Underwood's Civil War diary is one of those mysteries. Thank you. I might make one little comment before I give up the floor here. You probably noticed there are no pictures of Josie. I had turned this country upside down, as did her family, descendants, trying to find a picture. I could find a Ma and Pa. We have portraits of her parents. We have photographs and portraits of her uncle. But there are no pictures of Josie, or at least we couldn't find any. There are no pictures of the home at Mount Air, because, of course, it was burned. Another home was built there, and it was burned, so, you know. Just lots of mysteries. And, of course, there are very few illustrations for that period. So you'll have to excuse the fact that I didn't have good illustrations for the diary. Thank you.
Questions?
Do you think she had dark hair like her parents had dark hair?
I don't know. She makes a comment someplace of sparkling eyes. I don't know. She had enough bows that either she was very attractive or who knows?
Very rich.
Very rich, very something.
What was her educational background?
She had a high school degree. She completed her education at one of the private schools in Russellville. But she had also, when her father was sitting in the U.S. House, she attended a visitation convent in the Washington, D.C. area. So Josie was well educated, and her diary really shows it, the way she handles the language, etc., the wording that she is. She was well educated. She does a lot of quoting in the diary of some of the classics. She was well educated.
Was it Logan Female College?
Yes.
Do we know what they did in Scotland and how long you mentioned?
Well, her father was in Glasgow, and he was over there spying on shipbuilding, Confederate shipbuilding operations, in essence. And he thought that was beneath him. He didn't stay very long. He didn't like the job. But in essence, that's what he was there for. He was on the Clyde River, and there are shipbuilding operations there, and he was kind of keeping an eye on what was going on. He was also supposed to make sure that nothing happened that that severed the relationship between Great Britain and the U.S., and that was always a touch-and-go sort of thing during the Civil War, because Britain was trying to remain neutral, and, you know, sometimes that's difficult. But that was what he was there for.
Is there a Civil War cemetery in Bowling Green?
There's a part of the cemetery, Fairview, that's Civil War. One of the problems was a lot of the bodies were dug up and sent home. A lot of them, who knows who they were, because, you know, they had wooden crosses, and by the time they got around to it, the wooden crosses were gone. So there's a monument as you're going away from town out Cemetery Road. It's on the left-hand side, and it's close to the end of the cemetery, not far from Mount Ayr. I have a feeling that Mount Ayr Farm, part of that farm, becomes Fairview Cemetery.
How does Mount Ayr, A-I-R, become Mount Ayr, A-Y-R?
Okay, the first people that owned the farm called it A-Y-R, and I think Warner Underwood decided that was a little pretentious, and they always referred to it as A-I-R. And today it's got the Y in there instead, but the Underwoods decided that was pretentious. They were an interesting family.
Where was her father educated?
Her father went to Transylvania, and he had a law degree from University of Virginia, I think. I should have looked, I've forgotten. But he was well educated.
What was her married name?
Her married name was Nazro, N-A-Z-R-O. Her husband was Charles. They were from New York. And once again, I wrote everybody I could think of in New York asking, and nobody seemed to have any records. After they married, they lived here briefly. And Josie's husband and brother started a bank here in town, but it was short-lived. It was one of those that collapsed in the 70s. And I think that may have been one that somebody ran off with the funds, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And then they went back to New York, and we have a letter that Josie wrote from New York, and they are living in a rented house, mm-hmm. and her husband has a job for which he is only making, I think it's $100 a month, which wasn't a bad salary then. But she complains about the fact that she's having to do all this housework and that her hands are so rough that she would be embarrassed to shake hands with any of her former friends or friends from former days. So she never has an easy life like she had growing up in Bowling Green. But, you know, again, that's very typical of Southern families. It all went down the drain during the Civil War, and they never recouped. And they might have had Warner lived longer, but as I say, he had a stroke in 68 and died in 72, so he never had a chance.
Other questions? I think it's kind of odd now, we're all in these great celebrations for Lincoln and Lincoln garnering such little support in this area. Surprising.
Five votes and 1,300 votes in the whole state, and five in Warren County.
What happens to her siblings?
A couple of them grew up here. She had a daughter that married and lived here. She has some grandchildren that lived in this area and moved south. I don't know if any of you know Bill Koch that lived down at Auburn. McCutcheon Meadows. Any rate, that's her ever so great nephew. But as far as her children, they either moved west or didn't marry or had no children. So they're none here. Well, at least not that I know of.
None come out of the woodwork.
No.
Well, it's that time of the evening when we move to the door prize and. Shake them up and all over that. We have two tonight. We're going to first give away a copy of the book, which I'm sure Ms. Baird will be happy to autograph to you.
No, I think we need to do this again.
Yeah, do we?
Think anybody will believe me?
Carol Croker.
There you are.
Thank you. I didn't look.
And one more. For our copy of our new WKU Library's very own T-shirt. Actually, they're quite sharp.
Woo! Oh. Mary Branahan?
Mary Branahan.
Oh,
Mary. My buddy.
And then Peggy?
Money we have not. Gratitude we are overwhelmed. Thank you. Just a little thing to say. Oh. Remember that you came.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, on behalf of WKU Libraries and our friends of the group. We want to thank you all for coming out. We hope you'll be our guest next month in Kentucky Live. I think October 15th we'll be having a presentation from Mike Gellerman. We'll be talking about memoirs of a Western Kentucky coal miner. And if you're of a mind, we'll be in our Faraway Places series launching our 10th season next Thursday, same place, same time, with a presentation on Slovenia. So we hope you'll join us then. And please join us if you're interested in getting an autographed copy of the book back here. We'll have Nancy put her autograph to a few of these. And thanks very much for coming out. And good evening.
Would you like that?